Welcome to Sojourner Truth. Thank you for staying with us. This is your host, Margaret Prescott. Today, the Trump administration wants the voter rolls from all states, including Social Security numbers, all voters in the United States. What's behind this request? Our guest is Barbara Arnwine, a veteran voting rights advocate. And Trump and Putin will meet this week as part of the G20 meetings taking place. What are the key conflicts and concerns between the U.S. and Russia? And what is expected, if anything, to come out of the meeting? We speak with political analyst Gilbert Doctorow, who is on the ground in St. Petersburg, Russia. And we kick off our series, Campaigners for Black Lives. We will be joined by Charles Lyles, the father of Charlena Lyles, killed by police in front of her children, and Dr. Malina Abdullah of Black Lives Matter, Los Angeles. We live in a global world. We're all interrelated. So on Sojourner Truth, we work to bring directly to you news and views on local, national, and international policies and stories that affect us all. And we draw out how those of us most impacted, women, communities of color, and other communities are responding. We also discuss the interrelationship between art and politics. Now for our news headlines.
For Pacifica Radio, I'm Eileen Alfandary. North Korean leader Kim Jong-un is vowing he will never put his nation's weapons programs up for negotiation. The statement came a day after the North carried out its first successful test of an intercontinental ballistic missile. Analysts say the test suggests North Korea now could have the capability to strike Alaska. The U.S., South Korea, and Japan called an emergency meeting of the United Nations Security Council. It takes place this afternoon. President Donald Trump expressed frustration with China this morning. He tweeted, quote, "Trade between China and North Korea grew almost 40% in the first quarter. So much for China working with us, but we had to give it a try." China and Russia are calling for a freeze on North Korea's ballistic missile testing. The two also urged a freeze on U.S. military training exercises with South Korea and on deployment of the THAAD anti-missile system. Russian President Vladimir Putin's remarks appeared on Al Jazeera.
There is, of course, the whole question of the Korean Peninsula, the building of peace and stability. It is very important to push forward our joint initiative on settling the Korean problem with a view of immediately freezing the ballistic missile strikes and also dealing with the U.S. deployment of weapons in South Korea.
In a show of force directly responding to the North Korean missile launch, the U.S. and South Korean soldiers fired deep strike precision missiles into South Korean territorial waters. Donald Trump has departed for a four-day European visit. His first stop is Poland, where he's likely to receive a relatively friendly welcome. Then he'll travel to Germany for a meeting of G20 economic powers and a private meeting with Russian President Vladimir Putin on the sidelines of the conference. Tens of thousands of protesters are expected to take to the streets in Hamburg, Germany, with civil disobedience planned for Friday. German security forces have mobilized. Video from the independent media group Unicorn Riot showed tanks in the streets and droves of police officers. Activists are planning a global solidarity summit to coincide with the G20 summit. Foreign ministers from Saudi Arabia, Egypt, the United Arab Emirates, and Bahrain are meeting to discuss their next steps in their dispute with Qatar. The meeting came hours after Qatar responded to their list of 13 demands for ending the crisis. The four cut ties to Qatar early last month, accusing it of supporting hardline militant groups in the region. Among the demands were that Qatar shut down the news network Al Jazeera. Qatar denies the charges that it supports extremists and calls the blockade of the country clear aggression and an insult to international treaties. Qatar's foreign minister Mohammed bin Abdulrahman Al Thani discussed the demands at a speech in London.
The ultimatum did not only demand the shutting down of Al Jazeera, but also other news outlets based here in the United Kingdom that represent free press for the people of the Middle East. Reading between the lines, the blockading countries were demanding that we must surrender our sovereignty as the price for ending the siege, something they knew Qatar would never do.
Kuwait has been trying to negotiate a resolution to the crisis in the Gulf. A New York City police officer was shot and killed as she sat in her patrol vehicle at the end of her shift. Police say 34-year-old Alexander Bonds walked up to the passenger side of the police truck Miosota's Familia was sitting in and fired one shot, striking her in the head. Officers responding to the call shot and killed Bonds about a block away. The New York City Police Commissioner says the attack on Familia was unprovoked. At least three different legal challenges have been filed against the federal decision to lift protections for grizzly bears in the Yellowstone National Park area. Those protections have been in place for more than 40 years. The Northern Cheyenne Tribe, Center for Biological Diversity, the Humane Society, and Wildlife Guardians are among those challenging the plan to lift restrictions this summer. Grizzlies in all the continental U.S. states except Alaska have been protected under the Endangered Species Act since 1975, when just 136 bears roamed in and around Yellowstone. There are now an estimated 700 grizzlies in the area. The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service concluded that means the grizzly population has recovered. The group Earth Justice says grizzlies are at only 1 to 2% of their historic numbers, and they have only 1% of their historic range as human development encroached on their habitat. I'm Eileen Alfandari. You're listening to Sojourner Truth on Pacifica Radio.
This is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth. And Donald Trump has kept his promise about looking into what he says 3 to 5 million people who voted in the last election who were not eligible to vote, voter fraud. Keep in mind that Trump lost the popular vote by 3 million people. He has now established an presidential advisory commission on election integrity. He set that up last month, and the commission is led by Vice President Mike Pence and co-chaired by Kansas Secretary of State Chris Kobach. Now, Chris has a reputation for pushing forward this myth, widely acknowledged myth, of widespread voter fraud. Now, thus far, 44 states have refused to meet Trump's request. And the request, by the way, includes personal information, including the last four digits of Social Security numbers and others. Let's go to a clip now from CNN on the voter roll controversy.
4th of July and states coast to coast are showing their independence in the face of the sweeping presidential request for voter information. All but a handful are either flat out refusing to share data, offering only some of it, or saying the White House needs to go through other channels to obtain it. Many are citing privacy concerns and legal barriers, while others are openly questioning the administration's motives.
It's not really clear what this data is going to be used for. It seems to maybe be a fishing expedition or a witch hunt of some kind.
The president has long argued with no proof that massive voter fraud occurred in last fall's election involving millions of ballots.
So many things are going on.
But even some states willing to provide some information don't necessarily buy that.
I do not believe that vote fraud occurred on the scale that's been described. I do believe that vote fraud occurs, and it's important to take steps to prevent it.
The Electronic Privacy Information Center, a privacy advocacy group here in D.C., has asked a federal court to temporarily block the White House effort. Meanwhile, the point man on the president's commission, Kansas Secretary of State Chris Kobach, is steadily defending the request for info.
There's a lot of skepticism that it's essentially trying to validate what the president said and or could lead to voter suppression.
So let me answer your questions. First of all, the commission's purpose is not to prove or disprove what the president speculated about back in January. The purpose of the commission is to find facts and put them on the table.
But the facts are already being twisted, as many states have looked at the White House shopping list and noted their own laws forbid releasing some of that data, especially any portion of a voter's Social Security number. Kobach penned an op-ed on Breitbart, a far-right website, saying the commission didn't request that information. Really? Look at his letter to the states, While Kobach noted some laws might prevent it, he did indeed ask for the last four digits of Social Security number, if available.
Now I'd like to welcome our guests to discuss all of this. I'd like to welcome back Barbara Arnwine, veteran civil rights and human rights leader and advocate. She's currently the executive director of the Transformative Justice Coalition. For 26 years, she was executive director of the Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights. She's known internationally for her work defending the Civil Rights Act and for voting rights. She is an award-winning advocate. Barbara Arnwine, welcome.
Hi, thank you so much, Margaret, for covering this subject.
Barbara, tell us, well, first of all, we heard in the clip a summary of what's being asked, but
yes.
You know, you and I know perfectly well what this is all about. And I, for one, don't want the Trump administration having my personal voting information, social security number, et cetera. I mean, you know, in this day and age, it's dangerous, among other things.
Well, it's outrageous because there are several things that CNN didn't say. So let's talk about it. One is that it also requests the voting records for everyone, how people voted, how many times did they vote in the primaries, the general elections since 2006, and it requests your party affiliation for how you were registered and for what party each election. It also requests that they have the information on. They have your, address, your everything. So one of the problems that no one's talking about is that this data that has been requested has not been requested in what's called a secure form, meaning that most of this data, once transferred, will be hackable. So this is like a hacker's delight, a hacker's, universe, because they would be able to match people by name, Social Security number, by birth date, by party affiliation, by address. They would be able to, if you fear identity theft, this is the ultimate provision for identity theft. So this is a very, not only harebrained, illegal overreach by the federal government, but it's also very dangerous to individuals. And I say to the three states that are talking about, they think this is a good idea, Tennessee, Colorado, Missouri, the voters in those states should be in uproar. They should be alarmed because this isn't just about, do you support the president? Do you think that there was voter fraud? This also puts your life in jeopardy. So you need to be upset. Tennessee, Colorado, Missouri, also the states that have not said anything yet, Hawaii, Illinois, Michigan, you should be upset in those states, and you should be calling your Secretary of State, calling your election officials, and saying, stop it, don't do it. And I'm so glad that red and blue states have said this is so out of the bounds that they are refusing to provide this information.
Yeah, and you're right about it being dangerous. I mean, the other considerations, I mean, there's all of this flap about Russia hacking the U.S. election.
Right.
Now, the U.S., they hack other people's elections. I mean, Haiti to point and others. So Russia certainly isn't the first one or the only one doing that sort of thing. But also, my neighborhood, inner city neighborhood, is being gentrified. And I've already had a racist incident with one of the gentrifiers, right? People can go online and get my address, personal information, voting records, and who knows, that could lead to just harassment, especially given the divide, increasing divide, and the racial, what's called racial animus, but good old-fashioned racism and other types of discrimination in this country. Barbara?
Well, the beauty of the beauty and the problems with our electoral system is that every county, every division that administers an election is a separate entity, which means that currently throughout the United States, there's no centralized list at all that does what they're talking about. There's no centralized. But once you centralize this information, it is a hacker's delight. It is a hacker's paradise. The other problem is that what they're trying to do is they're sneaky. They're trying to do a couple things. One is that they're trying to find some basis for trying to argue that there needs to be a national federal program of what's called cross-check. Cross-check is now a voluntary program of the states that attempts to match names to see if people are registered in more than one state, if they are participating in elections in more than one state. But the reality is that the program has been so bad in the past because the few states that have used it have, you know, really been terrible at purging voters because they see names that sound alike. For example, there are four Barbara Arnwines in this nation. I know of them because when I try to do credit, sometimes their names come up. And one of them is a friend. She's a family member. So there are, you know, four Barbara Arnwines. But they would think on if you had a state that does cross-check, they would say, well, all of us are the same person. And they would attempt then to purge all four of us off their voter registration list, even though we are totally different people. One, my relative, she's white. I'm black. I mean, there's just no similarity. We're close in age, but we are not at all the same person. So what they have done is that this has been a problem in the states that have been doing it because a lot of African Americans, we know that a huge percentage of us say have the same last names. You know, the same 20 last surnames. So it's been horrible for African Americans. It's been terrible for Latinos. So if you're, you know, Marcia, you know, Blanco, and there are, you know, many Marcia Blancos throughout the country, you also face the same problem. So what they want to do is take what has been a horrible program and make it national. And they're trying to do that. They're also trying to use this information clearly for political purposes. In fact, you saw that the Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights Under Law, my prior organization that I headed, filed a complaint with the Attorney General of the United States saying that Chris Kobach has, you know, he's running for governor. He's vice chair of this commission, and he's running for governor, and he has been using his position on this commission as propaganda, saying this is why he should be elected. That is a violation of the Hatch Act. So, you know, you can't have it both ways. So, you know, there's all of these problems, you know, tied up in what is allegedly, you know, some kind of, you know, voter integrity commission. We know what it really is. It's a voter suppression commission. And that's why I'm so glad Congressman Mark Vesey has said, shut it down. That he has proposed H.R. 3029 that would defund, not one taxpayer dollar could be used to fund this commission.
Yeah, and Vanita Gupta, who ran the Civil Rights Division of the Justice Department under Obama administration, agrees with you. She says Pence and Kobach are laying the groundwork for voter suppression, plain and simple. And Barbara, another consideration also is that Mother Jones is reporting that federal law prohibits election officials from removing names from the rolls without specific indications that they're no longer eligible. So that means that inevitably they're going to be people maybe who recently passed away, whatever, and the information hasn't gotten in, so that there may in fact be errors. And clearly, I think part of the intent is to use that sort of thing to further push voter suppression.
Well, we've seen this over and over and over. In North Carolina, there was an allegation of thousands upon thousands of illegal voters who were on the voter registration rolls, and that this was, you know, evidence that, you know, voter fraud. Well, North Carolina did their investigation. They were under all this pressure. And guess how many people they found? They couldn't even find 200 people who were illegally, quote, registered, or who were no longer alive and were registered, or who somehow had moved and were registered. They couldn't, out of this allegation of over 35,000 such people, it turned out they couldn't even come up with 200. That is the problem we're talking about. It's this overreach, this over-narrative, this narrative trying to create fear and, in our fear and what do we call distrust in our electoral system. There are problems. Let me be very clear. There are problems in our electoral system. It should be easier for people to vote. We should have automatic voter registration, which many states have been passing, so that people don't have to go through so much hell to register. But also, it should be easier for people to know that their information is protected, that the voting cannot be hacked, and we haven't done everything to protect the security of our actual voter machinery. So there are things that we need to do, but this whole thing about voter fraud is nothing but a fraud in and of itself, and people need to let that narrative go, because every study that's ever been done, and there's been so many of these studies, I'm not talking about one or two, I'm talking about several studies that have been done by reputable groups, including some Republican-leaning groups, that show that voter fraud is de minimis, that it doesn't really exist. The best they've been able to come up with recently has been about 30 cases that they can do of voter impersonation fraud when we got millions upon millions upon millions, hundreds of millions of people voting. I mean, it's just a ridiculous waste.
Yeah.
And all it's done is to create this distrust. That's why you got red and blue states angry, because they're saying, listen, we're doing the best we can to administer our elections. Don't be saying that we're so incompetent that we've allowed millions of people who aren't, qualified to be voters to be voters. They said, that's just a lie. Stop it.
Yeah, and Mississippi apparently said they could go jump into the Gulf of Mexico, right, with this. But Barbara, finally,
I mean, state of Mississippi, right?
Yeah, really. I have to say, for my listeners who consider themselves revolutionary and therefore don't vote, I tell you, Trump and his friends, they don't want you to vote, okay? They do not want you to vote. So people might want to reconsider and see voting really as an act of rebellion. You know what I'm saying? So, Barbara.
It always has been. That's how the entire process of blacks being able to vote in this country, of Latinos being able to vote in this country, has been an act of rebellion. And listen, when you're seeing what the Congress is trying to do with this health care reform, where they're talking about, throwing out the insurance, 22 million people are altogether repealing the ACA, meaning that 32 million people will not be able to have any kind of health insurance, will be dying in the streets, will be unable to, take care of their needs. Listen, that's the result of your not voting. That's not called revolutionary. That's called stupid. That's called destructive. That's called irresponsible, because one in five Americans have Medicaid. A lot of us all Medicare. They're talking about cutting both of those programs by billions, not millions, by billions of dollars. That means that people in your household, family members, friends, all of them will be affected by this.
Right.
So your failure to vote has allowed this kind of Congress to exist that thinks that this kind of deadly, inhumane treatment is righteous. It's wrong. It should not exist. Let's vote, people. Let's register. Let's do our job.
Yeah, there are lots of ways to be a revolutionary or to work for social
lot.
Change. Barbara, we're going to have to wrap it up. We got to go on to this Russia-Syria situation with Trump and Putin meeting. But Barbara, quickly, for people who want to follow your work and be in touch with the Transformative Justice Coalition, what should they do? Is there any contact?
We're at tjcoalition.org. T as in transformative, J as in justice, coalition.org. And we put out a weekly newsletter called The Transformer, where we follow what's going on in the federal government, what's going on in the states, what's just. We give you ways to be involved. We also run a sister site called Voting, the Voting Rights Alliance.net.
Okay.
But to get involved, people, We need you. Come on, let's do this. Let's make this country what it needs to be instead of being distracted by all this insane nonsense, illegal nonsense.
All righty. Well, thank you for that. And we'll post these sites also on our social media.
Thank you, Barbara Arnwine. Thank you for joining us. Thank you. Bye-bye.
This is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth. Now, this Friday, the highly anticipated first face-to-face meeting between Donald Trump and Vladimir Putin is set to take place during the G20 summit, which is taking place in Hamburg, Germany. Now, despite trading words of flattery over the past few years, some people called it a bromance. Trump once tweeting that Putin could become his new best friend, both telling the press they gave each other A grades in 2015. Since Trump was elected president, however, the relationship is a bit more uncertain. Now, in April, Putin said that the trust between Russia and the U.S. was worse than it had been under President Obama. One of the biggest reasons for this, not the only reason, but a big reason, is Syria. Putin and Trump stand on opposite sides of a proxy war. Russia is backing Bashar al-Assad's government. Trump, who long advocated for staying out of Syria, has now reversed course over the past few months and upping his hawkish involvement in the region. On April 6th, Trump launched 59 Tomahawk missiles onto a Syrian airbase, killing 15 people. The act of aggression, said the White House, was retaliation for what they say was a sarin gas attack on a Syrian town 2 days prior. Now, Trump claimed this sarin attack was committed by the Syrian government and covered up by Russia, even though a handful of investigative reports, including a recent expose from Seymour Hersh, say the U.S. intelligence knew that Assad's government was not responsible for the chemical attack. And Trump has doubled down as recently as last week, where he claimed that the Syrian government was preparing a second chemical attack from the same base that the alleged first chemical attack took place, if that makes any sense to anybody, and threatening to retaliate. And then he further claimed that his threats stopped a second chemical attack by the Assad government. And on June 18th, the U.S. F-18 warplane shot down a Syrian aircraft over eastern Syria in violation of international law. Okay, so a deputy chairman of Russia's Committee on Defense and Security called the attack on the aircraft, quote, a provocation directed against Russia. And in response to the shootdown, Russia threatened to target its missiles at any U.S. warplane that crosses the Euphrates River. And Russian officials have said that this divide on Syria will be a key piece of Trump and Putin's meeting, which is taking place this Friday, along with Ukraine, international terrorism, U.S.-Russia ties. And now, of course, there's North Korea, given the missile launch, the birthday gift from North Korea, they say, to the United States. Now, people in the United States are responding. 10,000 people have signed a petition put out by Roots Action that says, tell Trump and Putin, negotiate, don't escalate. So we would like to welcome our guest to discuss all of this. He is a Brussels-based political analyst, but he is on the ground in St. Petersburg, Russia. It's Gilbert Doctorow. His latest book, Does Russia Have a Future?, was published in August 2015. And his upcoming book, Does the United States Have a Future?, will be out this September. And you could read his latest piece, U.S. Risks Wider War by Downing Syrian Plane, in consortiumnews.com. So, Gilbert, welcome.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
Well, Gilbert, what we're going to play is just a mainstream media. In fact, the Wall Street Journal put out a piece about four things they say to watch out for in this Putin-Trump discussion. So let's go to that clip right now and then hear what you have to say about all this.
The biggest event on the international stage this week figures to be the meeting between President Trump and Russian President Vladimir Putin. What should we expect out of that meeting? Well, this meeting, first of all, is going to take place in Hamburg, Germany, on the sidelines of a G20 summit meeting, a summit meeting of leaders from around the industrialized world. It's not clear whether this will be a big, formal, and lengthy meeting or a short, informal, and brief meeting. But either way, I think there are four things to look out for. The first one is the overall atmospherics. This is going to be important because President Trump clearly wants to have improved relations between the U.S. and Russia, but he also has to be careful not to have it appear too friendly because he's doing this meeting amidst a lot of investigations into whether his campaign somehow colluded with or cooperated with or at least benefited from Russian interference in the 2016 election. So he has to show that he can have a friendlier relationship with President Putin without making people think that it's a little too friendly and that fuels suspicions of what happened in 2016. Second issue is sanctions. You know, after the 2016 election, the Obama administration imposed some additional sanctions on Russia precisely because of these charges that it interfered in the 2016 election. And the Senate has actually now passed legislation that would add to those sanctions. The Trump administration's attitude toward both sets of sanctions is a little unclear, not clear at all whether President Trump might, as he suggested in the past, want to roll back those Obama administration-era sanctions, or whether he can accept the additional sanctions that Congress is working on. So the signals sent on sanctions are important. Third issue, Syria. The U.S. forces are dangerously close to brushing up against Russian forces in Syria. The U.S. is trying to help anti-Syrian regime militias in the fight there, both against ISIS and against the regime. And the Russian forces are supporters of that Syrian regime. There have been a lot of close calls. I think the question of whether they can de-conflict in Syria is going to be an important one. And finally, I think the question of Ukraine. Will Donald Trump press Vladimir Putin to do something about the kind of continued pressure that is being exerted on Ukraine from the Kremlin? And will the subject of Crimea, a part of Ukraine that has been taken over by Russian forces, even come up? I think that people here who are unhappy with Russian behavior around the world will be looking for signs that the president signals continued unhappiness with the way Russia's behaving in Ukraine.
Right. So that, Gilbert, is actually Gerald Seb, the executive Washington editor of The Wall Street Journal. So he talked about the four things: atmospherics, the photo ops, sanctions, the Syria, and Ukraine. But your take on this conversation that's supposed to happen. What are your concerns about it? Some of the things you think will come up and what may come out of it, if anything, Gilbert?
I think you were very wise in calling it a discussion because a lot of media speak of it as a summit, and that is really out of place entirely.
Mm-hmm.
Summits, meetings of U.S. and Soviet and Russian presidents were and have to be prepared by large teams. They have what are called Sherpas who prepare the way for climbing to that summit, to the apex. And none of that has happened. The possibility of some kind of agreement of any kind on anything taking place within, I think it's 25 minutes have been allotted to this meeting on the sidelines of the G20 on Friday. To go past the atmospherics is asking too much.
I don't really
see any substance. There's no room for substance because substance has to be prepared. Now, let me backtrack. There is something resembling a Sherpa activity that's gone on in the last 7-10 days. And that was the arrival in Moscow of Henry Kissinger, who came at this time, as he did the same time last year, for what are the Yevgeny Primakov readings. Primakov was a very important Russian government official, served in various functions, was a specialist in the Middle East, and was served from 1996 for several years as the Minister of Foreign Affairs. In any case, Kissinger arrived for that to deliver a lecture at the meeting, and one of the first things he did, I think, in Moscow, was to have a tete-a-tete with Vladimir Putin. Before he arrived in Moscow, he apparently had a discussion with Donald Trump. So it is quite possible that he was doing an errand for the president, and it is possible that he would have, by his efforts here in Moscow, some influence on what takes place in Hamburg. The point of commonality between Kissinger and Putin is they're both are realists. That is, they both look to a foreign policy based on national interest. We'll see if that brings any substance whatsoever to what is otherwise essentially a photo opportunity on Friday.
Right. And you're absolutely right. I mean, 25 minutes, come on, right? You know, there's so much hype around this Trump-Putin meeting. And Gilbert, because as you could imagine, so many people, including myself, I might add, are terribly upset about what Donald Trump's election, what he's doing in this country, the racial animus it has unleashed, the growing income divide among people. And some are definitely using this quote unquote Russia meddling in the U.S. election as a way to go after Trump. And there's been some criticism of that. And frankly, my personal view is that I think that they all meddle in elections. I mean, the U.S. meddles in other elections. I was down in Haiti for the last presidential election. And clearly, the United States, they select the presidents, right, of Haiti, even though there's a vote going on. So there's a bit of double speak going on there. But you are on the ground in St. Petersburg, and there are two things before you go. One is your take on how Trump is seen by just regular folks on the ground there and Trump's relationship with Putin, but also the conflict in Syria, because the Russian government did say that they will, you know, have the right to, as they put it, you know, shoot down its missiles at any U.S. warplane that crosses the Euphrates River. But who knows? I haven't heard whether any of that has happened. So is that just a whole lot of talk, Gilbert?
The Russians have made it very plain that another attack on Syria, under pretexts that they consider totally false, namely the use of chemical weapons or threatened use of chemical weapons by Assad's forces, that this is totally unacceptable and that they will take military action against it. Now, they or allies will take military action. It may necessarily be the Russians. It could be the Iranians with whom they are fighting the same fight against the Islamic State and in support of the Assad government. Syria is the single most threatening issue in the world today, the single issue that could spark a confrontation, if not an exchange of missiles between the United States and Russia. And if Donald Trump and Vladimir Putin achieve anything, it would be to agree to assign the Syria conflict to a joint team to pursue further the deconflictation along the Euphrates, to pursue what even the Washington Post in David Ignatius's article today was speaking of, some settlement in Syria between the United States and Russia. That is, if you have the Washington Post coming out publishing David on this awful idea of an accommodation with the Russians on something so important, then there is hope that this can be achieved. But I'd like to take a back step back because you're asking me what are impressions I have from being in Russia or from visiting Russia, or as you may be aware, from appearing as I have for a half year period of stardom when I was appearing on almost all of the Russian political talk shows for the domestic audience. That is that I don't accept for a minute the notion of Russian interference in the U.S. elections. You spoke of it in passing as if it's a fact. I'm sorry, it's not a fact. It's an allegation, nothing more than an allegation. That I have as my insight is conversations I've had with Kremlin insiders who made it very plain in the days before the election that they had serious doubts about Donald Trump and that they preferred the devil they knew, namely Hillary Clinton, to the unpredictable, volatile, and possibly very dangerous Donald Trump. You didn't like Trump for a number of reasons, and you may be surprised. The Russians, that is the Kremlin, the elites in Russia, didn't like him for the same reasons. They were concerned about his stability. They were concerned about his vanity. This is something which makes nonsense of the notion that the Russians would have actively intervened in the election process to further the chances of Donald Trump. It defies all logic, but it defies a logic external to U.S. domestic politics.
Well, I think it, frankly, I think it's in a way a bit of a distraction, because while everybody's so focused on it, the Trump administration, in terms of health care, in terms of the environment, health care has started to get a bit more focused now. But some of the devastating policies that will affect not only people in the United States, but people starting with those of us in the global South are, you know, quickly going along. And so, you know, I hear what you're saying about it being an allegation and not a fact. The same could be said about Haiti. I happen to think that the world major powers, that they do get involved in this sort of thing. But who am I? I'm no expert, you know, on this. But finally, because we do have to go, what about, you know, North Korea coming into play here? And it seemed as though, on the one hand, Trump was talking about making, you know, this close relationship with Putin, which, as you were saying, likely is not the case. And then with President Xi of China. And now he seems to be going after China. And some people are saying, well, he seems to be wanting to play Russia against China, in particular in terms of North Korea and perhaps other things. But China and Russia also have an independent relationship, independent of Trump. And, you know, Trump may be hoping for the wrong thing, that he could somehow play one against the other. Just a quick final thought from you on that.
That is utterly hopeless. If he is pursuing such a policy, and I mean, there's reason to think he is, it is simply continuing what the last two American presidents have done. It is scandalous. If the evenings going back to Richard Nixon and Henry Kissinger mid to late 70s, where the United States became closer to either Beijing or Moscow than they were to one another. But all of those achievements have been totally undone in the last 20 years, when we have threatened separately both China and Russia. We have tried to contain them. We have put installations on their periphery. And we have, in the case of China, now we have very much upset their security by our naval presence in what they consider to be their territorial waters. We have done everything possible to drive the Russians and the Chinese together. That's not a natural alliance, but it is a real alliance today. And they put the two, may be aware, there was a statement made by Xi when he visited Moscow yesterday, and the statement was that they agree. Russia and China agree on a solution to North Korea. And the solution is that both the United States and North Korea step back.
Right.
So Trump's hopes for dividing them or using one against the other are totally useless.
Right. On that note, Gilbert, Dr. We're going to have to leave it there. And for people who want to read your article, you can go to consortiumnews.com, U.S. Risks Wider War by Downing Syrian Plane. Thank you for joining us, and I hope you join us again. Thank you.
Thanks so much. Bye-bye.
This is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth. We're going to take a short station break, and then coming up, campaigners for Black Lives.
I'm in the now, and it don't take no x-ray to see right through my smile. I know I'll be on the go, and it ain't no drink out there that can numb my soul. Oh no, and all we wanna do is take the chains off. All we wanna do is break the chains off, man. All we wanna do is be free. All we wanna do is be free. All we want to do is take the chains off.
Be Free by J. Cole. This is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth. If you've missed any part of this hour, check us out on SoundCloud. Just look for Sojourner Truth with Margaret Prescott. And if you're a member of Facebook, like and friend us on Facebook. And today we'd like to give a shout out to our SoundCloud listeners in the state of Michigan. And now we return to a new series that we are starting that focuses on what is happening around the country on campaigns and campaigners for Black lives. And I'd like to welcome first Dr. Melina Abdullah. She'll be partnering with us in this project, and she is with Black Lives Matter Los Angeles and head of the Pan-African Studies Department at Cal State LA. Melina Abdullah, welcome.
Thanks. Yes, I'm here.
Okay, there you go. Sure. And thank you for working with us on this series. I'd also like to welcome Charles Lyles. He is the father of Charlena Lyles. Charles Lyles, sympathy to you, and thank you for joining us.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Okay. On Sunday, June 18th, which happened to be Father's Day, Charlena Lyles, pregnant mother in Seattle, was shot and killed by the police in front of her children. Lyles had called the police to report an attempted burglary in her home that morning. Police claim that at some point when they were on the scene that she displayed a knife. Two officers then shot and killed her. Charles, let's just start with you here and anything else about this story that you would like our listeners to know, your reaction to what happened.
Well, for one thing, it happened on Father's Day. And my daughter was always trying to reach out to the police department because she was going through what they call it, battered woman syndrome.
Yeah.
And then, the boyfriend would always come over. She's trying to get a restraining order against the guy, the fathers of her kids.
Mm-mm-mm.
And so on this particular day, somebody broke in her house, and she called the police, and they came over and ended up killing her. And that's the part I don't understand. And I don't think she had a knife. That's just the story that they're saying to protect themselves.
Mm-hmm.
But if she did have a knife, she's only 90 pounds. She's a small woman, and she's about 90 pounds. So they could have kicked the knife out of her hand, mace. But I don't think she had a knife at all.
Yeah.
I think they just said that because they killed her, shot her 7 times.
Mm-mm-mm.
At close range in her house in front of her kids. And I just feel bad for my grandkids because they're going to have to go through that especially my oldest grandson. He's going to have to go through that for the rest of his life, seeing his mother laying there dead. And then the police made him step over her body to get out the house. And it's just devastating on our whole family right now, especially me as a father.
Oh,
and
my
she
God.
Was my only daughter. And I'd like the world to know that she's a fun-loving woman, caring mother, and her kids was her life.
Mm.
You know, so.
Yeah.
Now you got 4 kids, and she was 3 months pregnant. Now you got 4 kids with no mother at all.
Wow.
And it's just devastating to me. I mean, you know, it's devastating to me, and also I'm so hurt because me and her had a beautiful relationship, and now I won't be able to conversate with her no more in life.
Yeah. I just can't imagine what you and other family members must be going through. And you're right. I mean, she's a little woman. These are 2 strapping police officers, apparently neither one of them carrying a taser. And I can't imagine for the children what they will be going through. And one could only hope that this case, unlike so many other cases across the country, that there will be some justice. It won't bring Charlena back. But, you know, so many of us identify with Charlena. And Melina Abdullah, I'm a mom. You're a mom. Just put Charlena's murder by police in the context of what is happening in Los Angeles and across the country.
Yeah, I think, Mr. Lyles, I just want to, you know, offer my deepest sympathy and let you know that our hearts and our work are with you. I know that Mr. Lyles also raised Charlena. So,
Right.
So for it to happen on Father's Day, and oftentimes the kind of relationship that I know that you have with your daughter is one that we attribute to mothers, right? Having that, having raised them, having been the primary caretaker. And so as one who parents my children, I can't imagine what you're feeling, but I want you to know that we're praying and working for you as hard as we can. In terms of the national context, I think that one of the things that the killing of Charlena Lyles does for me, and I think for a lot of folks, is it shines a light on the fact that when police kill our folks, it's a horror. But I think when they kill a parent, it reminds us how it resonates far beyond that single loss of life, right? It resonates, it impacts her parents, and it also impacts her children. And so we have to do better. We have to be more creative in our solutions. The fact that she called the police for help also reminds us that, you know, maybe we need to, not maybe, we need alternatives to 911. We need community patrols that can respond, because the police do not respond in ways that honor and protect life. And, you know, in the case of Charlena Lyles, they didn't protect her life, nor did they even think about or protect the lives of the three children that were in the home. And she's the mother of four children, pregnant with her fifth, and they didn't consider that at all. So we need to, the language that we use is language of police abolition within Black Lives Matter. We don't believe that police can be reformed out of something that they were intended to be. We believe that police are creating the outcomes that were intended for them. So what alternatives are there? How can we invest in holistic approaches to public safety that invest in things like mental health resources and, you know, children's programs and community patrols and all of the things that we know actually make communities safe?
Yeah, and Malina Abdullah, we know that when a police officer, let's say, is killed, or even the killer of Trayvon Martin, Zimmerman, when he was on trial, you know, white folks raise all kinds of money. You know what I'm saying? Accounts were set up, and they got that kind of support. And one has to wonder that with four children Charlena has left behind, heartbroken family, they need therapy. They need practical support. You know, what are some of the things that our listeners, and Charles, you may want to comment on this, and Malina, I don't know if you know if there are any efforts on behalf of any of the Black Lives Matter groups in terms of, there's a systemic change that you spoke about, Malina, about the community patrols, et cetera, and then there's the immediate help that this particular family needs. Just some final thoughts from both of you on that.
Yeah, I'd like to say my grandson was 11 years old, right? So anytime something goes down, you're supposed to call the police. He's seen the police kill his mother.
Yeah.
So he's going to need a lot of help. He's not going to trust the police no more. I mean, how can you trust the police when they come in your house and kill your parent? So my grandson's going to need a lot of therapy. His sister and the other two little kids are going to need a lot of therapy to overcome what he witnessed.
Yeah.
You know? And so I'm just going to try to raise, my goal is to try to get all four grandkids and raise them myself, me and my wife. He's going to need a lot of therapy, and they are going to need a lot of therapy because they lost their mom.
Right. And a lot of practical support, because in losing their mom, yeah. they're also losing, you know, a certain amount of income support, you know, raising children
right, exactly.
costs, raising children costs money. You'll need a lot of that kind of support. But Melina, just some final thoughts from you. And this is a series, so we're going to be continuing this discussion, Melina. But final thoughts from you, and also how people can be in touch with Black Lives Matter.
Sure. Really quickly, there is a GoFundMe for Charlena Lyles. So you can just go on GoFundMe.com and search for Charlena Lyles, C-H-A-R-L-E-E-N-A, Lyles, L-Y-L-E-S. Mm-hmm. We're encouraging people to support that effort because we know that the family needs support. In terms of policy work, one of the things people should be aware of is that there is a Victims of Crime Fund. Unfortunately, when people are killed by police, they are not considered victims of crime. So those resources Good. That would provide therapeutic support, that would provide support for the funeral and so on, are not available to these folks,
oh my goodness.
Even though they need it. And so we need to push. So we want everybody to get involved in Black Lives Matter. National audiences can go to blacklivesmatter.com. If you are in Los Angeles, you can follow us on Twitter at BLMLA. And we're going to be continuing to do work with the Lyles family, who's based here in Southern California. Charlena Lyles was raised here, so she is a hometown person that we have to be working for justice for.
Right. Well, Dr. Melina Abdullah, thank you for your work. You're one of a fierce campaigner for Black lives. And Charles, thank you so much. My sister's husband actually was a single dad raising four daughters for many years. So I know all of what you have been through, and can't imagine what you're going through now. But thank you so much for joining us. Thank you both.
Thank you.
Thank you, Melina, for making this possible. We are out of time. If you'd like a copy of today's show, please contact the Pacifica Radio Archives at 1-800-735-0230. Go online to pacificaradioarchives.org. We'd like to thank the Sojourner Truth team, our assistant producer, Stephanie Case, our engineer, Kiana Williams. Sojourner Truth will be back on the air tomorrow. Thank you for listening. This is your host, Margaret Prescott.